listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I am so honored to begin our 20th anniversary with a special evening, a reading by our former U.S. Poet Laureate, Robert Haas, who has been the recipient of many awards, including the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Pulitzer Prize, and who, as our Poet Laureate from 1995 to 1997, spent 2 years battling American illiteracy, armed with the mantra, "Imagination makes communities." He also spoke all over the country and raised money to organize conferences like Watershed, which brought together noted novelists, poets, and storytellers to talk about writing, nature, and community. For Robert Haas, everything is connected. After his talk, Robert Haas will be joined in conversation by another widely lauded and much admired poet, Carol Muskie Dukes, who recently finished her term as Poet Laureate of California. Carol is the author of poetry, novels, essay collections, and co-editor of 2 anthologies, and she founded the PhD program in creative writing at USC, where she now teaches. So now a little quote from Mr. Yeats: "I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade." That stanza from Yeats's Lake Isle of Innisfree appears in context in an astonishing essay by Robert Haas, which he delivered at a literary conference in the Republic of Korea, titled "Study War No More, Violence, Literature, and Immanuel Kant," in which the poet essayist takes us from the invasion of Iraq to Thoreau's cabin to Yeats's Ireland. He unlocks the meaning of Kant's great essay on perpetual peace and explores the theme of violence in literature from Homer to Joseph Heller to Paul Celan to the poet himself. Standing in the galleries of the Chicago Art Institute with his 2 young sons, Robert Haas wants his 2 cherubic grandsons to pay attention to a carved stone statue of the Buddha, but what they really want to see is medieval armor and weaponry. He writes, "The granite that the Buddha was carved from is rock from the earth's first cooling, reheated to burning under intense pressure. Human metalwork is a replication of that process. Looking at the armor, you could almost hear the sound of the smithy's hammer. We were staring into the fire of transformation through which the human species had come to control most of the forms of life on Earth." Haas's essays in his new collection, What Light Can Do, employ his own fires of transformation. This writer's attention, his big heart, his deep curiosity transforms the subject, whether it is the poetry of Robinson Jeffers, the ecology of rivers, or the photographs of Robert Adams. This is writing of down-home radiance and alert openness. Please join me in welcoming Robert Haas and Carol Muskie Dukes to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you, John Sabo, and welcome to your new responsibilities. And thank you all for coming, and to brilliant Carol Muskie Dukes for joining me here. This book of essays is 20 years of work in the form. I went to college in the early 60s, and from the time I was 18, I would slip into the library and read the cultural journals of that time, the quarterlies, we called them, the Partisan Review and the Hudson Review and the Swanee Review. And it was the place where the first essays of James Baldwin were appearing, early stage of the civil rights movement. Astonishing essays like Nobody Knows My Name. It was the first writing of Clement Greenberg about art, the writing of Randall Jarrell about poetry, It was also the period when, if you went into the basement of City Lights bookstore, there were mimeograph journals where you could read things like an essay by somebody named Gary Snyder on a really bizarre subject. One of the essays in a journal called the Journal for the Protection of All Being was called Buddhist Anarchism. I didn't know what either of those things were. I didn't understand that Gary Snyder was in the process of inventing the culture of California. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I've always loved the essay as a form and considered it a brutal labor to write them. But over the years, I wrote them, and this is a gathering of them. This book, and maybe a place to begin, is the essay that Louise spoke of, this little bit in it. I was invited to go to the Republic of Korea. I'd been there before working for PEN, a writer's organization that was concerned about writers in prison, and fell in love with the country. It's, first of all, amazingly beautiful, and then we're so implicated as a people in its brutal history. My earliest memories have to do with that war seen in black and white on television, in which 2.5 million people perished because we turned a regional conflict into a showdown between the opponents in the Cold War. And the subject that they proposed to me was perpetual peace. This was about 3 weeks after the invasion of Iraq, which I thought was crazy ideologues punching a wasp's nest. I couldn't understand how they were done it, and I couldn't understand how turning on television and seeing the rippling flags and the tanks rolling along the desert highways, people didn't understand that it was insane and going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. And so it was very hard, the idea of writing an essay on the subject of perpetual peace. I was raised a Catholic, so perpetual peace meant for me things like the Mass for the dead, may the perpetual light shine upon them. And it turns out that that's where the phrase perpetual peace comes from. I was walking with my daughter, then an adult, and I said, perpetual peace, they're talking about the idea of perpetual peace. She said, maybe they mean Immanuel Kant's essay. And so when your own child knows 18th century philosophers better than you do, and I said, oh, okay, so I read the essay. It was written in 1795, and it's very short. And Kant says, after all the endless bickering wars of the 18th century, with all the maimings that went with them, maybe it's time, hasn't been done before in human history, for philosophy to propose that maybe human reason can think about ending war. Maybe it could think about the possibility of perpetual peace. He said, a completely hopeless enterprise. But he was in the city of Leiden, and he looked up at the sign over a tobacconist's shop, and carved in wood was the figure of the shopkeeper leaning against a gravestone in a graveyard, contentedly smoking his pipe. And underneath it said in Dutch, de ewige Frieden, perpetual peace. Thus, a Dutch shopkeeper at the end of the 18th century thinking about his future rewards. So Kant set the idea of an essay up with irony, and then he went ahead to invent democratic legislatures that would have the power to prevent war and control the purse strings. He invented the idea of a United Nations. He invented the idea of Geneva Accords, of rules of war that would be conducted that would limit its brutality and cruelty. It's an incredibly inspiring essay. And I thought, well, maybe we ought to try to write about this subject. And then I found myself thinking about all the reasons why it was impossible. Here's a little bit of that. This past weekend, I met my daughter and her family in Chicago. We were going to spend a day in the big city and take my grandchildren to the Art Institute. I was a little surprised that they were so willing, in fact, eager to go to a museum. It turned out that what the boys, aged 8 and 10, looked forward to seeing was the museum's large collection of armor and weapons. Both of the boys are at an age when, if I say so myself, they look like Botticellian angels. I regarded their shining eyes and their rosy cheeks and their blonde curls for a moment and set out in search of the armor. As it happened, the way there led through the galleries of Asian art, where we faced, as we were passing, seated on a pedestal, a very beautiful 8th century Cambodian Buddha, carved from granite of soft gray-brown. The figure had legs folded, eyelids shut, the index finger and thumb of each hand touching to enclose the circuit of contained and overwhelmingly peaceful energy that the figure expressed. The granite glowed under an artfully placed light, and I said to my grandsons, "Okay, if we're going to go look at the armor, we need to stop here for a minute." And I told them the story of Prince Siddhartha, how his father had brought him up in the kingdom in the Himalayan foothills in such a way that he would never see any form of human suffering. How when he was a young man and curious, he snuck out of the palace compound and visited the local village. How he saw there a sick man and a poor man and a beggar and a corpse, and how, overcome with infinite sorrow at human suffering, he vowed to set out on a path that would lead him to overcome the violence in the human heart. I looked into the face of my 8-year-old grandson, who was looking up at the Buddha. He had an expression on his face of almost perfect patience. I understood that he understood that I was, in effect, telling him to wash his hands before dinner. We walked the rest of the way through the Asian galleries, and then we came to dinner. It would suit my purposes if what we first saw was a savage, old, brutally efficient Mycenaean battle helmet with eye slits and a nose guard, but what we came to first was a whole suit of French armor from the 13th century, ornamented with patterns of fleur-de-lis and covered in chainmail that actually looked fairly delicate. "Cool," my grandson said, and stared at it for a long while before he moved on to the rest of the helmets, swords, daggers, pikes, lances, maces, gauntlets, battle axes, and flails. All of it brilliantly worked in metal. The granite that the Buddha was carved from is rock from the earth's first cooling, reheated to burning under intense pressure. That's how granite is made. Human metalwork is a replication of that process. Looking at the armor, you could almost hear the sound of the smithy's hammer. We were staring into the fire of transformation through which the human species had come to control most of the forms of life on Earth. So it's a bit of that prose. There are essays on photography, essays on fiction writers, on poetry and politics, on the environment. One of them is appropriate for tonight, is a piece about a brilliant book of the photographs of Robert Adams called Los Angeles. And here's a little bit of that. Those skies in the photographs of Robert Adams. The Los Angeles basin has always been hazy. It was probably hazy 10 or 12,000 years ago when the first humans came upon it. It was marshy grassland then, watered by 3 seasonal rivers that flowed out of the mountains in that semi-arid climate. The hills were covered with coastal scrub, as they still are in places. Low-growing herb and sage and vanilla-scented fire-loving plants. They were watered by cold, moisture-laden sea air from time to time. The cold air didn't rise easily in that climate and had trouble getting over the mountains, and the plants made use of it, made a relatively lush place for its kind in that Mediterranean climate. In the last 80 years, human development added to this naturally occurring phenomenon the exhaust of millions of automobiles, which, trapped in this inversion layer of cold air, reacts with sunlight to produce smog. Adam's images give us the visual effect. It is as if the idea of sky were being erased. We see this so clearly in his photographs because we're seeing it through the lens of art. The whole tradition of landscape photography, in fact, of landscape, European landscape art, has been about the relation between earth and sky. So that looking at the photographs, we see in a way we might not, walking through it, that there is no sky in these images, that it has been replaced by a kind of gray backdrop. The Hungarian critic George Lukács once described the 19th century novel with its everyday realism as the epic of a world abandoned by God. The absence of sky in Adam's photographs has a similar effect. The way light in European art has always been a metaphor for the conversation between heaven and earth is so muted in them that we seem to be looking at a world that has had to struggle along without having heard a rumor of that conversation. It's hard to say whether they make tragic or poignant or desperately comic the idea of available light, but the brilliance of light in the Los Angeles basin, occasional, and the erased sky from other times present to us in a way that seems very much of our time the riddle of exactly what light can do. I take the title of this thing. So that's another kind of piece here. Our format is to get in a conversation with Carol. I'll read a few more sentences to give you a flavor of the different kinds of things. Here is an essay on meditation. On the most remarkable to me of the modern Japanese photographers is a guy named Hosoi, who is both a high fashion photographer and an art photographer. His art photography is very Baroque. He invents stage sets and puts his figures in it. And among the most remarkable of them is a book of semi-erotic photographs of the novelist Mushima, photographed against a landscape of kind of pseudo-Tuscan, Italianate landscapes that stir with a powerful sense of death that I think is the way Hiroshima has haunted Japanese culture. We sense in them really terrifying powers. And one of our responses to this sense, stirring and moving toward us from the territory of death and denial, is to begin to fear that those powers are more powerful than life. Humans tend to make alliances with power. In black magic, through such an alliance, the abject, the terrifying, and the dead assume demonic power. In the more playful as-ifs of art, they achieve magical potency. But let's think a bit about abjection. It exists at, defines a boundary between self and not self, good and not good. The art of this boundary is the art of thresholds, the place of disturbances. And the art of disturbance is to function at that threshold where transmigration seems to be going on between life and death, good and evil, pain and pleasure, male and female, the ugly and the beautiful. We're in the kingdom of reversals. I suppose an ecological account of this would be to say that human beings are comfortable with the carbon cycle, the basic process of birth, growth, decay, death, and birth, as long as it operates in a clockwise cycle, so that death always produces new life. Black magic and terror begin with the thought that the processes might be reversible, the hand emerging from the grave, from the coffin, the monster from the swamp, effluent creatures from the sewers, from the toilet. They are another flowering, the flowering of unnature that terrifies and fascinates us, that gave Baudelaire the title of his book of poems. And so on from there to that. One other little bit, maybe. Here's a piece. There are several poems about poetry and politics. There are poems about my idea of how to, I was trying to figure out how to write about poetry as I experience it, which is living with it over time for years. So this is an essay called Wallace Stevens in the World, and my idea was, since there are not very many people in the poems of Wallace Stevens, I would write about a lot of people in whom there are the poem, in whom there is Wallace Stevens. Right? So So this is a little meditation. And then there was the incident of the snowman. You know that poem that begins, "One must have a mind of winter," talks about not projecting feelings onto the landscape, and ends by saying, "If you don't, you will see nothing that is not there." And the last terrifying line to college sophomores, "And the nothing that is." It occurred at a wedding at the end of my sophomore year of a woman we all liked, large, placid, Irish drama major, and the daughter of the man who conducted the last big band and the last CD, once glamorous, dance hall in San Francisco in the 1950s, where dancing to Maury Monahan's orchestra was a citywide trope for absurdly retro behavior. She was marrying a classmate we didn't like very much. I think we were jealous, but we all showed up for the wedding, and at the reception, in one of the rooms of a house that sat over a steep hillside cliff, another of my classmates announced that he was going to kill himself. I came onto this drama late, and it's still not clear to me how it began, but when I came into the room, there was a small knot of people standing around one of my friends. His name was Zach. He was an acting student who was standing by an open window. He looked wild-eyed, and he was talking to his friend Tony, with whom I knew he'd been in the Navy. They were inseparable friends, and they cultivated a certain cool bleakness that was stylish then, and were the first among us to start wearing black turtleneck sweaters, which was the symbol of cool bleakness, so that someone in our group had called them the Laurel and Hardy of tragedy. At that moment, it looked to me distinctly as if Tony was goading Zach. They had apparently been talking about the void, the term for nothingness we all used. And Zach must have spoken of his despair because Tony was telling him scornfully that he didn't feel despair because he didn't feel anything. He was always acting, always a fake, generating histrionics to make himself feel real, feel anything at all. "Look, jump if you want to," Tony was saying to him. "Who do you think cares?" "And you know," he said, "you might have to do it now because you're talking yourself into it." At that point, Zach said, "I feel it." Hit his stomach. "I feel it. You know the nothing that is not there and the nothing that is? Well, this is the nothing that fucking is, baby." I thought later that there was something like sexual tension between them, and at that moment, I thought that Zach really might jump and that Tony was clearly trying to cut off his avenues of escape. But the truth is, I was so besotted with literature at that time that I remember mainly being impressed that someone could quote Wallace Stevens at a moment like that. As it happened, Zach did not jump. The bride, Agnes, came into the room after Zach had climbed out the window and onto the balcony, and she began talking to him and then suggested we all leave, which we did, and after a while they came downstairs together and danced to her father's orchestra. If I were Vladimir Nabokov, I might leave them dancing to "Did You Ever See a Dream Walking?", which I have recently read was one of Wallace Stevens' favorite songs and was the kind of song Agnes's father was apt to play. But I can't touch Nabokov, and I have some sense of shame. As for the nothing that is, I was soon enough in graduate school where the discussion of the poem focused on whether or not it was in favor of the pathetic fallacy, which was another matter. And not long after that, I began to read around in Buddhism and to see that there were other ways of thinking about the void, and that what I loved in the cleanness of the writing of that poem might be connected to those other ways. So I think that's enough for me for here. Thanks.
Wow. You know, when you said, "I think that's enough," I could almost hear out there, "No, no, it's not." Now you're going to be subjected to this annoying woman asking you questions. In fact, I wrote this little spiel. I hope that it's okay to just subject you to it. Just a couple things about the book. Is that okay?
Please. Yeah.
The essays, as you've noticed, are engaging and enlightening. And there's another aspect to them that is so Haasian, or what I would call Haasian. They're enjoyable. Your style is that we experience as readers what you experience, which happens in poetry, but to my mind doesn't happen that often in essays. And there's much talk now about the lyric essay, I know you know, but I'm not exactly sure that's what these essays are, but they are such extraordinary experiences, each of them. And This is the sign of a remarkable prose stylist, obviously, as you are. But the reader settles into the voice. There's not that sense of fake portentousness that you get with a lot of essays. Like, this is really important stuff. For example, you have in the book there is an essay on Edward Taylor and the beginnings of American poetry. And Bob takes off on a kind of Lewis Carrollish riff about the word bibble. Riff on bibble, I love that anyway. As used by Taylor, the word, its origins and uses becomes a surprising and canny insight into Taylor's imagination and American poetry itself. And here's your observation about Taylor at one point. Still, the only thing that seems American about him, and presciently so, is this strange absence of a social context for his work. Like Anne Bradstreet, he is an early instance of the solitariness, self-sufficiency, and peculiarity of American imagination. Of the American imagination. That observation about what is American about imagination becomes a useful lens. And also when you talk about photography, through which to gaze at the other species of imagination in the book, it seems to me. The subtitle notes that these are essays on art, photography, the imagination, and the natural world. But you also visit that fraught arena of debate, and I can't resist it, poetry and politics. Mm-hmm. Which so many writers have tried to take a stand in to connect themselves or not, to awkwardly canonize the political poets. Mandelstam, of course, comes to mind. You said everybody has written a poem about Mandelstam. Every poet has written a poem about Mandelstam at one point or another, to align the imagination with this extraordinary hero, and yet you recast him when you talk about politics and the whole idea of families in prisons. I think it's in the essay, Families in Prison. That we have limited, within that territory, we find that there's a whole other way to perceive what we think of as the political. So I'd like to talk about maybe a little, not just poets and politics, to talk about poets and politics rather than politics in poetry. But I also want to quote you on the essay itself from your author's note. You say that one of the things you love about the essay as a form is that the essay is an act of attention. And, of course, that's what D.H. Lawrence called poetry, an act of attention. And I see the connection in terms of the energy. I find myself reading your prose the way I read your poetry, with that kind of high alert attention. And you say the essay is a search, an inquiry, or as you say, you are often discovering the object of inquiry and the shape of the search at the same time. So in terms of the shape of the search and poems and politics, poetry and politics, I'm thinking in particular about how you contextualize Robinson Jeffers in your essay, The Fury of Robinson Jeffers, how he seems like a conventional Republican to his neighbors, but espouses a far different version of conservatism and isolationism and the non-human and the geological, to Peter Dale Scott, this amazing poet who I hadn't known, Canadian poet, his extraordinary vision of empire-making in his poem, Coming to Jakarta, American Intelligence, the CIA in Indonesia leading up to the Vietnam War. Both of these poets, though one Canadian, seem to me examples of that solitariness, that self-sufficiency and peculiarity of imagination. Mm-hmm. And then your meditation on the martyr poets and how we want to associate ourselves with them, Mandelstam and so on. And I also want to say, when you talk about Maxine Hong Kingston, her description of foot binding is one of the most extraordinary hands to visions of feminism and the breaking of the bones that I have ever read. And it's the way you, I mean, it's, I know it's her writing, but you contextualize it in a way. You I think what Bob does is some almost subsumes what he's writing about, and that is the act of attention that you're talking about. So that's my intro, and I'll leave now. Thank you very much. But I don't know where to begin, sort of, but I think that notion of the American imagination or an imagination, which we describe as American, as solitary and self-sufficient and peculiar, may be a place to begin to look possibly at some of the essays.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that the culture is changing, you know, that
our culture in America is
our culture right now. Yeah. So that what I was saying, that all every American artist is, I mean, maybe there are exceptions, is a maverick of some kind. I think it has to do with the size of the country, and maybe there are occasionally a young writer who grows up with the idea that literature or art painting or songwriting or acting or playwriting is a perfectly natural and respectable profession and something someone could do. But most people who practice any art fall in love with it, feel the intensity and power of it, and feel a million miles from any idea of the social place where you begin to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, embodied in a particular way in American distances. This guy, Edward Taylor, who was from the Midlands of England, came over in the second Puritan wave, and he I think he'd gotten kicked out of, nobody knows too much about his early history, but he'd gotten kicked out of either Oxford or Cambridge for being a nonconformist. Somehow made the passage money to get to New England and went to Harvard College. And the farthermost frontier then, little town near Springfield called Farmington on the Connecticut River, was a settlement of maybe 8 or 10 farm families, got up to 14, 15 farm families, still binding trees and clearing roots, wanted a minister. And they went in the middle of winter, the snow, it's about a 2-hour drive now, it took them 3 days to get to Cambridge and ask the people at Harvard to give them a minister. And
he's like, what about that guy?
And they got this guy who was the most learned, bookish, poet, dreamer imaginable, and he became the minister of the remotest American frontier.
And he also was, you said, quintessentially English still, and he was English.
He thought like an Englishman. All the animals in his poems are English. The games and technologies, but so were the people he was living among.
Yeah,
at that point, Frost saying the land was ours before we were the lands.
Yeah.
But he wrote amazing poems. He wrote for about 40 years. He would write a meditation preparatory to receiving communion sometime on a Saturday, and he bound them all in a book. And when he died, he was totally reactionary at the end of his career, and they couldn't wait to get rid of him, but he was so old. And he specifically asked his kin not to ever print his poems. And they turned up in a light, and they're amazing. And they turned up written in the style of 17th century metaphysical poetry, but with a really weird imagination.
Right.
And a scholar working on Emily Dickinson came across this leather-bound book in Yale Library, I think, and because the Connecticut River flows down that way, and he was on the Connecticut River, so it didn't get to Harvard. It got to Yale somehow, this book. And this guy, turning the pages of it, who's the first editor of Emily Dickinson's, modern editor of Emily Dickinson, right, turned the pages and realized that he was reading a major poet.
Yeah.
And wrote a little article in 1937, and then people published some of them, and then they published more, and they were finally published in 1956, the same year that Howl was published. Right?
Yeah.
So he had a kind of belated debut as a as a writer. And the poems are, we don't know, apparently he didn't show them to friends. It's hard to imagine these poems. Many of them are kind of semi-erotic meditations on the descriptions of breast in the Song of Songs, and how that's the grace that Calvinist that flows from the Lord, and they're intensely peculiar and wonderful poems, and I was saying about them, the only thing that's American about the beginning of American poetry is here's this guy like Faulkner in the electrical plant that he worked in the middle of power plant he worked in the middle of the night while he supposedly listened to Bessie Smith records and
right,
sipped whiskeys and wrote The Sound and the Fury in His Eye Lay Dying. That Walt Whitman, who was a son of an alcoholic carpenter wandering the streets of Brooklyn dreaming up Song of Myself,
yeah,
Fitzgerald, the outsider coming to the big city, and so on and so on, that it's particularly true and a myth of the American imagination that we begin as loners, dreamers, and outsiders. I dare say it's true of everyone here, of your experience, of that part of yourself. It's not integrated into the social fabric. The point of it in some way is that it isn't.
Right, and that's how you began talking about, but I mean, other, you know, artists in Europe, some they go to Madrid or to Paris, they would go. Do you think it's not true that, that still that people go to this, to Los Angeles or to New York or to artists, young artists and writers, still, or not so true anymore because of the internet? There's this kind of, and because of the globalization.
I think that's one of the ways in which it's changing, and then it's just changing because, so, you know, when Wallace Stevens and Gertrude Stein were writing, I think the figure is 300ths of the population had any higher education.
300?
Yeah, .03.
Any higher education?
Any higher education. They were mostly ministers. That was still mainly the reason people went to college. And they were just beginning to have English studies and to do science, not just Hebrew, right. Greek, and Latin for future ministers. So now something like 40-50% of us have some higher education.
Although public education did have a kind of Latinate base, and there were studies. Yeah. People did learn, you know, the Palmer myth. They learned how to read Shakespeare and so on. Yeah. Even at the elementary level, that was part of the American experience in public education.
We both have had the job of being poets laureate, which means you become a spokesperson in a way.
And I was appointed by Schwarzenegger. That's a little different. I beg to differ there. Yeah. Anyway.
Actually, I think it's the same gig. I was trying to kind of read enough to see if I knew what I was talking about. And the beginning of the teaching of vernacular literature in English was in elocution classes.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, my mother will talk about, you know, way back on the prairie in North Dakota, elocution was how they learned.
I was going to ask you about that, about what, because you grew up right in the smack in the middle of Midwestern culture. It was no longer an immigrant culture. It's different elements, right? Scandinavian and Eastern European. And
well, in Minnesota, definitely. But
how did the idea of being an artist work when you were a teenager for you?
Well, I mean, first of all, I want to go back to your essays. I thought I could be a poet, though, from what you're saying, because my mother recited poetry to me. Mm-hmm. And she recited poetry because she had learned it in elocution class. Yeah. Her mother died when she was 16. Her English teacher sort of became her mother and comforted her through poetry. Yeah. My mother can still, she's 96 and can recite Tennyson and Shakespeare and Milton and Wordsworth. And, you know, I mean, thank you. Elsie would love that. I will convey your applause, because I was just visiting her in Minnesota about 2 weeks ago, or about 3 weeks ago, and my sister and I videoed her. She was reciting, she was doing a Portia speech on mercy, the quality of mercy is not strained, and then she did The World is Too Much Worth Getting and Spending, and then she did Milton's Sonnet on His Blindness, and my sister kept poking me and saying, recite with her, and I kept saying, oh no, because I grew up in that ocean of her voice, those words, and I think that she wanted to be a poet and ended up, you know, married with six kids and wasn't a writer, but, you know, I think that, odd to say it, but elocution, the sound of her voice, and she didn't, you know, get the breath right, the line breaks right, but that voice, the singularity, just what you're talking about, the peculiarity, the idiosyncratic sound of the voice in poetry, how it was personalized through the voice, made me think I could be a poet.
Yeah. My wife, Brenda Hillman, brilliant poet.
Yes.
Is here. Her grandmother, I think, she's the first woman to get a master's degree in the state of Mississippi, and in English, and taught English in a little school in the Pine Barrens in the 20s and 30s, and with the shelf of, you know, outside in the sheds, they'd be smoking the slaughtered hogs that they raised on the farm, and inside there'd be the Bible and Tennyson and
Well, they had the Harvard Classics from 1932. Yeah. Sometimes that was the year that I think it really, that particular volume got disseminated. Yeah. But the English teachers were like an army of advance army of, you know, enlightenment.
My maternal grandmother grew up in Butte, Montana, which in the middle of the mining boom. And it was a middle-class family. Her dad was an engineer and a justice of the peace. But she got her books that way from the Harvard Classics, subscribed to, brought in the mail, and she could recite
all poetry. Those poems.
What culture we're evolving in that way, and whether it will make the possibility seem more at home, will be interesting. And what the internet will do with that is going to be really interesting to see.
I want to ask you to get. I don't want to belabor this, and there is no way to talk about all these thing enormities in this amount of time. But and I'm trying to watch the clock, but I can't really see it. Anyway, what I was going to say is that you were, famously roughed up in Berkeley. It wasn't an Occupy movement, but it was a protest.
It was the Occupy.
Was it Occupy?
It was Berkeley campus version of Occupy.
And I went down to the Occupy, down to Zuccotti Park in New York, and was, talking to young people there. And when you wrote your op-ed piece, I was thinking about, do you think that, again, you're talking about how different it is now, culture evolving in that way. Is the political culture changing? I guess I want to get you back, if I can, just briefly, to. I'm trying to set up this horrible triangulation, which isn't working, but Robinson Jeffers sort of is our Republican, wrongly designated that way. And then Peter Dale Scott and coming to Jakarta, on the other hand, is sort of, the liberal, I don't want to say innocent, but who gradually becomes educated as to, like Pound, and writes like Pound. And Pound is another one to talk about in this regard, too. Yeah. We're talking about, modernism. But in the middle, perhaps, this notion of how we perceive politics now, maybe, in poetry, as a chance for martyrdom, in quotes, or a chance to be canonized in this awkward way. Mm-hmm. Does that make, or no?
Yeah,
that's
I
not
change.
Is it changing the politics?
I don't know. I don't know the answer, but it should be. Yeah. If it isn't, it should be.
Should be from what?
My experience of this, and I don't know what yours is or you folks, but in the 60s when I was starting to write, I think I met you in 71.
71 or 2, something like that.
She was this little blonde girl from the Midwest who blew
I still am, honey.
Poems.
Not much has changed except my hair.
We were energized by politically engaged writing of all kinds, and the backdrop to a lot of what people were doing was the European writing of the 40s and 50s during the war period, so the success wave of things from the existentialist writing that flowed out of World War II, from
the Spanish surrealists.
And the writing of the civil rights movement and the beginning of the writings of the feminist movement made poetry, which already seemed incredibly exciting to me, also feel like a fundamental part of the conversation.
It was. I mean, we were just talking about Plath meeting Adrienne Rich and in Cambridge 100 years ago, but actually there's a year's difference between them, but I wrote a piece for the New York Times about this Plath meeting Rich, and Plath's comment about her is, I met Adrienne Cecile Rich today, red umbrella, black shiny hair, black button eyes, somewhat opinionated. And my commentary was that, the one with the opinions has lived to her whatever year, Sylvia. Sylvia also was opinionated. But, that was the milieu. That was just before that, though. I mean, I think that, it's interesting to think about Plath and Rich. Rich, who became so much in our minds anyway, this political force and emblematic, whereas Plath, this is impossible to talk about, isn't it?
Well,
it's impossible to talk about.
This is one of the things that essays can be for, is how you have that.
This is why you just have to buy the book and read it, because it's...
So how would you talk about the politics of Jackson Pollock, or the politics of Mark Rothko? But if a given writer or artist or musician in a particular period becomes a spiritual force,
right,
in the way, say, that those people did, then they have a politics.
And yeah, they become a spiritual force. That means,
yeah,
yeah.
Well, I mean, the way that German philosophers found a way to talk about musicians in this way, but
right
at the moment, I don't think.
Well,
we do.
You have so many extraordinary insights about this, but when you talk about Jefferson, for example, you say his neighbors thought he was a Republican, mm-hmm, and by their lights, their definition of Republican, mm-hmm, and they built houses sort of like, mm-hmm, his, you know, round like baby birds, with their mouths open to the sea. Yeah. You said, but his peculiar Edward Taylor like in a sense solitariness, mm-hmm, was unique. And isn't, or is the illusion of uniqueness part of what we're talking about? That my politics,
yeah,
or a poet's, uh-huh, politics,
yeah,
seem to be not necessarily isolationist within, yeah, the imagination, but unique.
He was, I think, my impression is more isolated from his peers.
Oh,
than,
yeah,
any of the other poets of his generation. That Eliot and Pound were friends, Wallace Stevens,
right,
and William Carlos Williams and Marianne Moore saw each other at New York parties. And way out on the coast, Jeffers was more or less by himself.
Yeah, but wanted to be.
Wanted to be, yeah. And his attitude toward those other poets is very contemptuous.
Right, but still... You're eloquent about it. I mean, he was a major poet, and he, what, at least, you know, in some of the poems, and had some vision of America that persists.
Yeah.
And
that challenges us still.
And challenges, yeah, us still,
yeah,
right? I mean, can I just talk about coming to, or ask you about coming to Jakarta,
yeah,
just very briefly? Could I, I think it's about 10 after, I think we have 5 more minutes to talk, so can you,
yeah,
just talk about coming to Jakarta? Indulge me, because I love this essay in particular.
This poem by a Canadian poet, son of a Canadian poet, quite famous in Canada, not to us Americans who don't read enough Canadian poetry, attorney and law professor F.R. Scott, was one of the founders of the Canadian Socialist Party, which... That, right, Canadian socialism of the 1930s would be moderately progressive democratic politics.
Yeah.
Now, but it was left politics. His son, Peter, became a diplomat, went to Harvard and was a junior fellow, did other things, but ended up being a Canadian diplomat, serving some time in Poland and some time in the United Nations and some time in Indonesia. And he retired from that business to become a literature teacher in Berkeley, where he's,
yeah,
a colleague of mine. And he wrote a book-length poem, somewhat in the style of Ezra Pound, about something that had been... And he also writes investigative books. He's written a book about the Kennedy assassination. He's written a book about the CIA in Afghanistan and the cocaine trade in Afghanistan,
right,
and how that works. So he likes to... He has, in his poems, he talks about having one desk for poetry and one desk for...
He said he had three desks,
for studying,
I think, right?
literature and the classics, and one desk for his political writing. This poem is about... It traces the history of the development of the Council on Foreign Relations, the CIA, and the way that Americans, relatively innocent, inherited the British Empire and its problems and responded to it with a single-minded anti-communism that led to, for example, having one idea about the entire Middle East, which was to crush any form of left or progressive thinking. Communist, socialist, labor,
right,
movement, secular humanism, leaving nothing left for the young and the restless to be interested in except right-wing fundamentalist religion, which, because it wasn't communist, they thought it was safe.
Right. And it becomes a model for...
And it became a model for what's going on now.
Yeah, right now.
And the poem tells this story. The CIA... in Indonesia in those years, helped the Sukarno regime by using their network of spies to let everybody know who the progressive labor union people, communist, socialist, leftist school teachers, and so on, throughout the entire country, where they fed the names to the military, and the military in those years killed in one large, brutal massacre so that the rivers ran red with blood. It's a metaphor, but it's literally true. 500,000 people. And it was the success. Do we know about that? Do Americans know that story?
Yeah,
we don't know that story. And
he chooses to tell it in poetry, which is, you know, as you of course talk about Pound, but there's a similar sort of, you know, outrage and yet lyrical obsession.
Anyway, it's a fascinating, brilliant, ambitious
extraordinary poem.
And it begins when he's a Canadian kid on a lake in Ontario. One side of the lake is the old Virginia aristocracy summer homes. The other side of the lake is funky Canadian academic summer homes. And when the season was over, the kids would canoe over to the Dulles family's estate, full of sexual curiosity, finding their way into the books. And he talks about himself gazing into the water and seeing strange patterns that he associated with the pictures of naked natives in his grandfather's National Geographic collection.
Wasn't it the sexual life of savages?
So out of this weird, erotic thing, he tells the story of John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, the creation of American foreign policy, and traces it down to the supposed success of the slaughter in Indonesia, which led to the containment program in Vietnam, which led to the 2.5 million lives and the 55,000 dead Americans in Vietnam. It's not a perfect poem. It's full of complicated information, but it's really an amazing thing. So I wrote
a
long...
It's like the cantos in the way. I mean, I keep bringing it up, but it works because of the power of the imagination again.
It's also a meditation on the male warrior ethic.
Yeah.
And the way that works out, connected to the piece of writing about my grandson.
I was just going to say about the armor, right? I mean, there you
armor,
have the kind of... Extraordinary connection made. I think we should now, I think the time is right, to open this up to questions and questions and some answers. And I guess we have someone already asking. Anyway, thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you. Conversation.
Do you think these poets, I mean, as much as they want to inform people about what they've experienced or what they know, they feel kind of safer if they do it in poetry form? Because it's like, oh, no, because it can be interpreted in so many ways, but they feel that they can still get their message across.
Do I think that it's safer to talk about this stuff in poems than it would be in prose? No, I don't. I think that it would be safer I'm thinking of. I told my younger brother once that I was writing something about him. Was that okay? And he said, in a poem. And I said, yeah. He said, oh, sure, nobody's going to read it. So it might be safer. And that's, by the way, my mother said in response to that, yes, nobody reads it, but for a very long time. Nobody's been reading Catullus for 2,000 years. So no, not exactly. And I think the risks of poetry, not to be melodramatic about it, the risks of imagination for all of us are their own. You know, the risk of wading into a poem on such a complex subject is one thing, but into such a complex subject in which he's involved his own violence, tried to connect sort of white ruling class sexual curiosity of a Canadian boy to the underside of politics and to the you know, there's a sexual subtext that we're seeing to the stuff that's being stirred up about the Muslim world. Back in the 80s or 70s, Robert Bly wrote poems called Terror of People with Black Hair, from his Midwesterner's rage about American foreign policy going around policing the world. So there are all kinds of dangers for artists, and what's safe for artists is that there's no rush. You can work at it till you get it right. Almost all prose has to be written to some deadline or other. So poets have come to feel that they're the keepers of the record in a poem like this. People are right now, who's, you know, the truth of this, of what's happened in Libya, it's going to be so distorted and so confused that it's going to be years before that happens. And then some historian will do something about it. But I think poets have demonstrated in the 20th century that they're the keepers of the record in some way. Particularly European poets have had that feeling.
Hello. Listening to you and her, I'm kind of like intimidated by your intellect. However, I've written upwards of 1,500 poems, and a lot of mine are syllabically uniform, like Shakespeare and sonnets and the such, because of my OCD. But when you look at a blank page, what do you do?
You know, I'm not having a little trouble hearing you.
When you look at a blank page, what do you do?
I mean, for you.
Oh,
I mean,
God. I run in terror from blank page, you know. I don't know what your process is. Carol writes essays, reviews, poems, novels, and has recently written a play. She could do everything. I keep notes. I keep odds and ends of journals. I write things down when I'm thinking about it. And when I sit down to write, if I sit down to write a piece of prose, it's almost always on assignment, an essay. And then I really often do start with a blank page. But mostly I've already written some notes on a piece of paper. But particularly with poetry, I almost always start with the scrap that I've written down.
Yeah.
If I go to the blank page and say, "You're a poet, write a poem," I'm dead.
Yeah,
I can't get there. I have to sort of sneak up on it by looking at this piece of paper, and I'll see a line saying, "Nagged by wind."
Yeah.
Others on corners, nagged by wind. And I'll think, well, that's possible.
Yeah.
It's Christmas. Union Square. Others on, I'm shopping, others on corners, now, you know, da, 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 da. No, forget, it's not Christmas, it's spring, others on, anyway, then I can then I can do something. But blank page is terror to me. One time I was asked, when I was Poet Laureate, I had a student who got a job in public relations for the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, which is the place at Columbia University that developed global warming data. They were having a big conference to celebrate their 50th anniversary, and the title of the conference was The State of the Planet. And she called me up and said, we were thinking it would be really great if you could open it with reading a poem on the state of the planet. And I was in the peculiar state of a heightened lunatic egotism that gets produced by, my children called me the poet laundromat during that time. But still, I thought, yes, I'll write a poem on the state of the planet. And then I would get up every day and write on the top of a blank page, the state of the planet, and then I'd just put my head down. You know, that was all. So.
Well, and that goes along with the way people would perceive the Poet Laureate. Yeah. The British notion of the Poet Laureate was always occasional poem. You'd write a poem for the Queen Mum's birthday or a tube opening or something, and you would have to just come up with a poem. But in America, we had this, again, a little more egalitarian notion that you wouldn't have to write these occasional poems, but that's one.
What about you in prose and the blank page?
You know, I could write a poem called The Blank Page. I don't even think in terms of the blank page. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of like, I think it's 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to write something. Or it's two, you know, I've done everything I have to do. It's midnight, and I'm just gonna get this done. And so I'm so neurotic and crazy. I fool myself into thinking I've already written 10 pages, and they must be somewhere, but they're lost in my study. So I can just start in media res and start. It's a complete and utter delusion, of course. I'm insane.
Hey,
but you know, most
if it
writers
gets
are.
You there,
you know what? I mean, I don't know where it gets me, but it seems to work. But thinking of the blank, if I had to think, this is a blank page. I think it's one of the reasons why I resisted going to the computer for a while to write, because I would always write, I still do, poetry on yellow legal pads, which don't feel like a blank page. Why does a lined yellow legal pad never seem like a blank page? But going to the computer when you see a blank screen is a little bit intimidating.
How many of you who write first drafts on the computer?
Write what?
First drafts on the computer.
Only in prose.
How many write first drafts on paper? Majority.
See, I think, how many of you write first drafts of poems, if you're poets, on the computer? See, I don't.
You?
How many write them on paper?
Paper,
But I think in prose there would be, how many write a prose on the computer, first drafts? See, a lot more.
Yeah.
Probably prose by hand, though some people still do. What? Oh, sorry.
I'm wondering how you feel in contemporary society about how we feel about poetry and even literature.
Mm-hmm.
We're not reading poetry much or even literature very much. So what do you...
I probably don't have a very... I think Carol and I both in our different ways have somewhat distorted views of it, because we both are supported by institutions where the young come thronging, really curious and interested to read.
And really good
literature.
Writers. Often.
And to write it. And we go to places where there are audiences like this, where people want to talk about it and think about it. And all over the country, people are writing. There's a small writing program and also an arts program, theater program, music composition, dance program in almost every university, college, and community college in the country. In 1900, if Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio is right, anybody who had an imagination ended up running through the streets naked in the middle of the night going, now they find other like-minded people in our institutions. When Emily Dickinson's poems were published, and they were, again, it's very hard to get a hold on this, to imagine these other times. I mean, first of all, before, in Wordsworth time, about 40% of males and 15% of women in England could produce a signature. Not very many people could read at all. Public education and the idea of universal literacy was Protestant, began except in Japan where it had its own, but it was Protestant. It was Sweden, Scotland, and New England were the most literate places on earth at the beginning of the 19th century, because those people thought that everybody had to read the Bible for themselves to save their soul. And the Americans converted that into a religion of public education in order to have a democratic society. About 1840, they started thinking everybody has to learn to read, except black people. At that point, some parts of the country, you could get killed for trying to teach yourself to read, which shows how potent the idea of it was. But by the beginning of the 20th century, almost everybody could read a little bit. And a lot of people went to school and learned to recite a few poems. But how many, how deep it went into the culture, it's hard to say. But I was going to say, Emily Dickinson, 1890, I read, the first book was published, and it was a big bestseller. The first edition was 400. There were 50 million people in the country then. It went through 11 editions, and they increased the number. So anyway, maybe 5,000 copies of the book sold in a country of 50 million, which is probably not too far. I think Sylvia Plath, curious about this, I asked the publisher, American publisher of Sylvia Plath's Ariel, which was how many copies it sold. And I think in the first 10 years, it sold 300,000 copies. In a country then of, I don't know what the population was. But it made me think, well, probably about the same percentage of people are reading poetry intensely or reading as always have. It's probably a genetic thing.
There's also...
But the question is, you know, how much of intensity and liveliness do we have, but how committed are we to making sure that all the kids in L.A. learn to read, that they all have access to books, that this library is a place that's thrilling to them, that the conversation that a culture is will take them out of places where they could feel ashamed by whatever, by how they look, by what they desire, by all the things. All of us found our way to some place where we felt like we could be alive. And most of it came through the arts in one way or another.
That's right.
And I think the culture is probably doing about as good a job with that as it's ever done, and it's not good enough. Yeah.
There's also the fact that rap and hip-hop and spoken word are hugely popular. Now, I taught a course, actually, I never thought I would do this. I taught a course last semester at USC, a big lecture course, 120 students or something like that, on poetry and rap. And there is an anthology called the Yale, The Yale Anthology of Rap, and there are others too. This is not to say that rap is the same as the kind of poetry you or I or whomever may like, but there's a film, for example, called The Furious Force of Rhyme, and it is rhyme. All of it rhymes. Yeah. And it is you could call it the most primary impulse in poetry. I mean, the desire to make music, the desire to rhyme. This particular film, The Furious Force of Rhyme, which I really urge you to see, shows how, first of all, rap became what it is in the United States, how it spoke to black culture and so on, a little more focused on bling, according to this film, when it crosses the ocean, when rap becomes, when it goes to the Middle East, when it goes to Germany, when it goes to Asia, it's more concerned with politics and human rights. And these rappers are, it's poetry. I mean, they're using rhyme, it's poetry. It just depends on how you perceive poetry, what you think it should or should not be. But I tell you, when I taught this class, I mean, there were people who could recite on one hand, Philip Larkin's Obod, and then do a whole thing of Jay-Z, and happily coexist. Mm-hmm. So, I think poetry in whatever form it takes is alive and well. I can't see.
I'm interested, you've talked a lot about the interrelationship between prose and poetry, but especially with this essay collection. How do you see you've talked a bit about the role of witness that poetry plays. Have you found that essays offer a particular kind of witness as well in presenting this collection?
You know what? You're up there. I was trying to... It's hard to say. Would you say the last part again?
Yeah, I'm interested. You talked about the role of poetry in political witness or in witness to history.
Yeah.
I was interested in whether you found that essays... as a literary form, also offered a unique kind of witness.
I mean, there are a lot. As I mentioned, but I'll say it again, the essayist that inspired me the most when I was in college was James Baldwin. The essays in the two books, Nobody Knows My Name and Notes of a Native Son. It was just the early period of the civil rights movement. And I've reread them recently. They're just amazingly beautiful, vivid
crystalline
pieces of writing. And they bear witness really to what it was like for this self-conscious kid in the last years of American apartheid to think about to mirror back to the culture what racism was and what it did. And they were just thrilling as pieces of writing. And he wrote about the essays of Albert Camus, which sent me to them and gave me the idea that the lyrical essay could be as much as the short story or the poem a way of something to do. And there are an enormous number of interesting writers in the tradition of Orwell and of Camus and of Miłosz, essay. And there's a lot of border jumping going on in literature right now. One, I was thinking about as hip-hop spreads through the kind of poetry that's very appealing to recite spreads. Of course, one of the immediate responses of some of the young would be to go underground and lose interest in that poetry that is immediately accessible, you know,
yeah.
And start, so there's revival of interest in Gertrude Stein.
Right.
Fascination with Paul Celan, who was a poet, very difficult poet,
teaching
because
right
he felt
now.
Like he couldn't write in German, which
right.
killed his parents without breaking the German language. Interest in Cesar Vallejo, the great Peruvian poet who wrote the first kind of broken, fragmentary, baby talk, new invented, semi-surrealist poems out of a jail in Lima when he
right.
was a college kid. The energy is always going on a lot of different ways, at all levels, at all times. Poetry seems endlessly fertile in that
yeah,
way.
Yeah,
and part of that has been breaking down of those boundaries, the boundary between very, very short stories, which the Japanese call them five-finger stories. I think
yeah.
they're sudden fictions, they've been called.
And now they have the cell phone novel in Japan.
Yeah.
Which is
so what
frightening.
What the self what yeah what tweeting is going to do?
Tweeting, there's poems, the poetry of tweet.
Tweet haiku will probably be the next book.
Haiku Twitter. Okay, one last one. Yeah. Is that it?
Mr. Haas, I hope every student has the privilege of being exposed to such a graceful thinker in their. Is this better? Okay. Thank you so much. You're just the blessing of the greatest teacher possible. And Carol, I was so tempted when you said the Plath, the politics of Plath. Would you say she nourished the Betty Friedan moment, or how would you? I understand Adrienne Rich's politics, but how would you see Plath feeding feminism?
Plath's politics?
Plath would never have described herself as political, I don't think, and certainly didn't consider herself a feminist, but it wasn't that she wasn't independent, and that is not to say that there isn't politics in her poetry, which mm-hmm. is the distinction I was trying to make when we were talking about the essays about poets who are writing about politics. Because you cannot escape the fact that Sylvia Plath, even let's just take Ariel, but even the Colossus, you know, those poems, so many of those poems are about, you know, the struggle of a woman to articulate what it is to be a woman in a marriage, a woman in a poet who is clearly in competition with, feels she's fighting for her life with a partner, whether it's fair or not, fair-minded or not, fighting or struggling to be heard, you know, to write freely. All that is there, clearly, in Plath. But it would never have been, I don't think that she would have ever articulated it in terms of, you know, a sort of, you know, an argument that was documented as feminism, you know. Oh, I don't know enough about Betty Friedan to know whether she was. I doubt very much if she was influenced by women's writing. I think she was much more influenced by just the lives of women. I don't think that women's writings necessarily. I mean, she had to have read Simone de Beauvoir. I mean, that goes without saying. Second Sex. She had read The Second Sex. But I think she was again applying it particularly to American women and to the lives of American women. At a particular moment, at a particular time. But I really don't know. I doubt if she was influenced by women's writing or poetry. Am I wrong?
But what I would add to this about Plath, in addition to the very powerful thing she did about women's experience in gender politics, is the fury, the famously debated thing was her assimilation of imagery of the concentration camps to her private experience.
Oh, right, it was considered exploitative.
Identifying herself with the Jews and her father with the Nazis.
Right.
As a kind of violent hyperbole to talk about how injured she felt. But there is in her poems, in the poems of Ted Hughes of the same period, I'm thinking about the book Crow, which self-consciously draws on Eastern European poetry, but also Ginsberg's Howl, and also there's another poem of that time by Tom Gunn called The Last Man, which is imagination of every of being the last human on Earth. They all belong to that generation's to the shock of trying to assimilate what had happened. And the camps, Hiroshima,
right.
60 to 75 million people, depending on how you count, were killed in the Second World War.
And you were talking about the confessional, not the wrongness of the label, but the to some degree the inappropriateness of the label confessional. These were all considered confessional poets. Lowell Plath, Snodgrass originally, as you mentioned, a student. Both Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath were in Lowell's class, night class, right, in Cambridge. And they told their lives. It wasn't so much that they were part of a school of poetry as they just told their lives, and their lives included this information of, you know, dealing with the death camps. Plath's father was German. He was a he studied bees. What is that called? Apiarius.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the bee poems are as political in some ways as Daddy is, the poem Daddy, where she actually calls him a Nazi. And
but I would say about the autobiographical impulse is that it was in a way a response to the fury and nihilism in those earlier poems.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it would be very much Miłosz's way of thinking about this would be in the best of those poems. To me, nature is absolutely grotesque. I mean, she in the poems about being pregnant, she finds herself grotesque.
Yeah, you're talking about Plath now.
Plath.
Yeah, I mean, there are the poems to her children though that are very like, you know, when she's pregnant and she says you're the riddle in nine syllables. They're loving.
Yeah,
I mean, too.
Yeah. Well, as with the bee poems, nature, it was her love of Rilke's poems, was almost monstrous.
Yeah.
So if in the face of
The moon cackles and drags, the moon has its black, you know. I'm sorry. I do like it. I'm sorry.
We want to...
I'm sorry.
I just love it's wonderful. This is where attention goes. This is the poet's attention, and we want to thank you both so much for all of your observations.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.